Thank you. My name's Keith Lewis, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
I'm just delighted to be here with you. It's very much like a homecoming for me. I lived in Birmingham for a couple years in the 80s, and so flying into Birmingham and was sort of like, I used to fly in every week. Make me crazy. I had a job that had me on airplanes all the time, and I'd fly in and out of Birmingham all the time, and lived down there for a couple years, and so it was a lot like coming home. I really want to thank you so much for asking me to take part in this. It's always, you know, humbling to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, but especially something that has the history that's here and the reverence for the program that's here. And I really want to thank Kim and John for picking me up, and we stopped and had lunch and had some great conversation. I really enjoyed it. I enjoy talking to Kim these months while we're getting ready for this weekend. And I'd also like to thank my wife, who isn't here, but at this very moment, she's praying for me. She always prays when I speak. I told her I'd be talking about 8 hours this weekend, and she said I was going to be on my own most of the time. But she really does. We have a little room in our house that we've given to God. God gave us the house, so we give him a room, which seems fair somehow. And she goes in and closes the door and prays that, and I always ask her to pray, that you not hear what I say, but you hear what God would have you hear. And they're usually different, especially in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a wonderful organization. I can't tell you how many times people have come up to me and said, you know, that story you told about such and such saved my life. I never told that story, you know. But they heard that story, and that's what matters. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we just carry the message, and then you hear the message. And they're often not the same message, but it doesn't matter. God arranges all those things. And so I'm really, really delighted to be here. I'd like to ask, not to embarrass anyone, but is anybody here fairly new in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? Great. I am so pleased you're here. And I want to congratulate you for being here. I could not have been around this many people when I was new. I'd have been hanging on the ceiling or something like that. I mean, I was very, very nervous and very quick when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you're most welcome here. And if there's anything you don't understand, just grab somebody. What I'd like to do this weekend, with your permission, is to sort of drift through the steps. Okay? I'm not going to teach you about the steps, and I'm certainly not going to read to you from the books. I assume you have your own book, or if you don't, you can borrow one. Just kidding. And so I'm not going to read you from the book, but what I wanted to do was talk something about the principles of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous while going through the steps. And maybe share in a general way how I took them, or in some cases how I didn't take them, and what the results were. Before I get started, I want to mention something about Maggie. It's a great honor to be here with you. I was telling Maggie before dinner that we had a mutual friend. There was a man named Bob Brown, and Bob got sober in the Biscayne Room. And in the 70s, he moved to Washington, D.C., and he and I developed a friendship that can only happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. We were truly brothers, and Bob passed away a few years ago. And one of the stories I love, there's a clubhouse in the Washington, D.C. area out in Bethesda, and there was a lady there who sort of ran the place. And she came in, and Bob was doing something, and she began to chew him out. And Bob listened to her for about 30 seconds, and he said, just a minute. He said, if I can interrupt you just for a moment. He said, I just think it's fair to tell you that I got sober in the Biscayne Room, and Maggie used to chew me out. And a woman says, all hell, forget it. And that was the end of that. And true story, really a true story. I like to mention Bob because... like I say, Bob became one of my great friends, and I watched Bob Brown die of emphysema, and you would think a pretty horrible death, and it was quite the contrary. I saw a man who for 3 years couldn't even leave his home, and we started a meeting in his house, and he made every meeting, and he heard fifth steps every week, and 2 days before he died, he heard a man's fifth step. He constantly worked this program, and he learned that in Atlanta with Maggie. I remember one of our good friends had been diagnosed with brain cancer, and he could drive. And Bob, he would drive around and get newcomers and take them out, and Bob would prop himself up in bed and talk to them. And I never want to forget that picture as long as I live. It was sort of my version of the man in the bed. Only in this case, the man in the bed was the one who was doing the giving. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous on May the 13th, 1973, and I'm one of those fortunate people. From the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous until now, I have not had to take a drink. So it's something over 26 years. And I'm convinced that that's the case because I had a very severe case of alcoholism. And I didn't have a light case. And even when I arrived here, I had a very, very, very serious case of alcoholism. I also have to tell you that I'm one of those people who came to Alcoholics Anonymous by way of a treatment center. Now, some people don't like that, but that's how it happened for me. I was living in the basement of a house in the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C. of 29 years of age. My wife had requested that I leave our apartment, and the judge requested I leave the state of Maryland. So between the two of them, I got the message, and I went to where I needed to go, which was a basement of a house in Washington, D.C., and that's where the miracle happened for me. And the miracle was I drank all I could drink, and I couldn't drink anymore. May the 13th, 1973, I went into what passed for a bathroom, and I had one idea in mind, and that one idea was to die. And I would have thought that suicide was a big deal, but it's really not a big deal. For an alcoholic, suicide's just the next thing. It's just the next thing. In 12 years before this, in July of 1961, I was this 17-year-old, 113-pound kid who left a little town in Martins Ferry, Ohio. Took a bus from Wheeling, West Virginia to Pittsburgh, which is about 60 miles away. It's the second longest trip I'd ever been on. And once I went to Cleveland. And I was 13 years old, and I'd gone up there to join the Marine Corps. Now, I knew nothing about the Marine Corps. The only thing I knew was they occasionally took some people to a swamp in South Carolina and drowned them. That's the only thing I knew about the Marine Corps. And I was also knew I couldn't ask. I was always someone who knew he couldn't ask. And I also knew that everybody understood the big picture, except me. It was sort of like one day God put everybody in a big room and he said, I'm going to explain this once, pay attention. And he told everybody about how to grow up and how to be a real man and told them all about sex and about politics, told them about God and all that stuff. And I was in the bathroom. And the feeling I had my whole life was that everybody understood but me. And so my job was to go through life and act as though I understood the big picture. And the truth was I had no earthly idea of what was going on. And I even joined the Marine Corps because I didn't know what I wanted to do when I graduated from high school. And my thought was everybody knew what they wanted to do because you all seem so sure of yourselves. So I was convinced I was the only guy who was lost. And my thought was if I go away, they won't know that I don't know what it is I'm supposed to be doing. They'll think I'm doing it. So I had to go away. And back then, the way you went away was you either went to college, and there wasn't great danger of that, or to the military, because all the men went in the military. It wasn't if, it was where and when. And so I went up to Pittsburgh, and I joined the Marine Corps. And that night, in May of 1961, my life changed. And it changed in a way that was to map the course of my life. I had that profound awakening that happens to alcoholics. The first time most of us get an opportunity to drink as much as we want to drink. And I never want to forget it. There were three guys from Pittsburgh who had joined the same time I did, and our train was leaving that night. It was leaving at midnight. It was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we went over to a little bar. And I had no idea what we were going to do, but I just followed them over there, because that's what I did. I followed people around. And we went over and sat down. I like to say that I walked into this place and it was filled with real men, you know, the kind that, spit on the floor and have tattoos and they know all those words and you know, all of them had real women with them, you know, real women hang around with real men and guys like me get what's left and I remember, sitting at the table with these guys and the bartender came over. He was a real man and he said, "What do you want?" And I thought, "Oh my God, a quiz." And I always thought that when you least expected it, somebody was going to say, take out a blank sheet of paper and put your name in the upper left-hand corner. They're going to ask a lot of questions, none of which I'd studied. You know, I studied a lot. I just never studied the right stuff. And I did not answer a question like, what do you want? So I waited, and these guys ordered a beer, so I did too. And you know, years later, a psychologist would scratch his chin and say to me, why do you think you began to drink in the first place? Now, I knew that had to be an important question. So I remember I went home, and I got a fifth of scotch, and I went down by the stream all by myself, and I drank that whole fifth trying to figure out why I drank in the first place. And then I went down to Jim and Mac's Sunnybrook Farm, which was a hillbilly bar near where I lived. And I was sitting there, and I said to the guy next to me, tell me, why'd you drink in the first place? He said, shut up. I said, all right, I was just wondering, you know, I could never figure out why I drank. So I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you why I drank in the first place. I'm 17 years old. I weigh 113 pounds. You know, I've never been away from home. I have no earthly idea what's going on in the world. And I'm in a bar with three other guys, all of whom order a beer. And I just didn't have the intestinal fortitude to order a sarsaparilla. That's why I drank in the first place. And of course, for an alcoholic, it's not important why we drink, is it? What's important is what happens to us when we drink. And what happened to me was I had a profound spiritual awakening. And that's the only way I can describe it. Because what it did was, my reality was displaced. After somewhere between a second and a third drink, my life changed in a way that was to dictate the rest of my life. And that's a profound experience. And I remember I stood up. I didn't want to stand up. I just stood up. And I looked, and my whole world was different. The floor was 6 feet 4 inches below me, and my right shoulder was out there, and my left shoulder, and the muscles were rippling through my body, you know, and that mind that had been filled with fear and terror and everything, just like, boom, just like that. It was crystal clear. And I remember thinking, of course, it's so simple. Why didn't I see it before? I mean, life is so simple. And I understood the big picture. And then I looked around that place, and my heart broke because that place was filled with a bunch of pathetic, snivelling little men. You know, and all of them had women with them with their hungry eyes looking at me. You know how they do it. And it was incredible. It was one of the most incredible experiences I ever had in my life. And I spent the rest of the evening going from table to table answering questions. You know? I mean, here I am. I'm a guy who doesn't know anything. I'm as dumb as a tabletop. And a half hour later, I'm the most brilliant guy who ever lived. You know? Now, my sponsor is Tom I from Aberdeen, North Carolina. Now, Tom told me, he said, you know, you weren't yet alcoholic. You could have quit drinking. I said, Tom, who on earth would have wanted to? I mean, that's the greatest I ever felt in my life. And, I mean, it was spectacular. I was answering questions they didn't even ask. You know? And it seemed to me, it's about 11 o'clock and we had to go catch the train. And it seems to me, now this may not be entirely accurate, but this is my recollection, okay? It seems to me they were saying, please don't go, we've just discovered you. That's what it seems, you know? And, I mean, it was an amazing discovery for me. And I never knew life could be like that. And I went, I got on the train. I assume I got on the train. And I think it's reasonable to assume that because I woke up on the train the next morning. And that was one of many assumptions I was to make over the next 12 years. But I woke up and I was lying on the floor of the Pullman coach that the Marine Corps had provided for me. And it's hard to believe, but someone had wet the floor I was lying on. I know it's hard to believe, but they had. And whoever it was had also wet me. And a terrible thing had happened. I was 300 miles from home, and again, I was 17 years old, and I weighed 113 pounds, and I didn't know anything. It was just amazing. And I changed my clothes and got off the train, and the guys were waiting for me. And they said, what do you want to do? And I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to find some of what I had had the night before that changed my life. So we went to a place called the Monaco, and we began to drink, and got on a train. I was drunk. I got on a train in Washington, and back then, when the train crossed the line in North Carolina, they closed the club car. And I was screaming my objection, my hatred for the state of North Carolina until we got to South Carolina and they opened the club car back up. And I fell off the train in a place called Yamasee, South Carolina. Someone moved a bottom step or something. I fell across the next set of railroad tracks and there was a very rude man, Bob, that they had sent down there to talk to us, to welcome us. And he was hurling obscenities at myself and the other young men who had gone down there to die for their country. I tried to explain to this cretin that he'd probably get a lot further with us if he treated us with a little respect. You know, he never seemed to be able to grasp exactly what it was I was trying to say. He's a very limited man. And they say you can learn from every experience. And I'll tell you what I learned from that experience. I learned that you can do a lot of push-ups drunk. That's what I learned from that experience, you know. And I'll tell you, I hope you never have to use this information, but you can also do push-ups and throw-up at the same time, you know. And I did a lot of that. And then, you know, and they said there's something to be grateful for. I'm grateful we weren't doing sit-ups. That's what I'm grateful for. And I was launched into the Marine Corps. But it had happened to me. That thing had happened, you know. It had happened. And I tell you, I really loved the Marine Corps. And I often wondered why. I mean, you know, you got to be in line for the second step if you love Paris Island. But I just loved it, you know. And I wondered why. And, you know, I'd sober a number of years, and I finally figured out why I liked Paris Island. It was because I had spent the first 17 years of my life guessing at what my job description was. I don't know if anybody can relate to this, but I spent my whole life guessing at what it was I was supposed to do and be and all that stuff, you know. And the Marine Corps had a very, very clear idea of what it was they wanted you to do, and they weren't a bit hesitant about sharing it with you, you know. So I think that's why I loved it. And, you know, I packed on about 30 pounds, and I grew a few inches, and I won the Dress Blues Award, an Outstanding Man's Award off of Paris Island. I got meritorious promotion. And I was going to spend the rest of my life in the Marine Corps. I was home. You know, next to the nuns, it was easy. And I really was going to spend the rest of my life there. There's one problem, and it's a small problem, and the problem was I was alcoholic. That's the problem. And what being alcoholic means to me is that I will fall in love with a way of life. You know, the most enthusiastic people in the world are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. They really are. I mean, just enthusiastic people. And I was enthusiastic drunk, you know. I mean, I'd find a way of life, and I'd love it, and I'd throw myself into it 110%, and I'd go to great lengths and everything. And then I would begin to violate every principle associated with that way of life. See, because first step says I'm powerless over alcohol. My life has become unmanageable. What that means to me is that I'm a guy who, if he takes a drink, he can never predict what's going to happen. But I know that whatever happens is going to have something to do with the deterioration of my value system. You know, I began drinking in 1961. You know, in 1962, I was less the man I wanted to be than I had been in 1961. And in 1963, I'd violated more principles associated with being a Marine and a human being than I had in 1962. And that's the horror to me of alcoholism. Every year, I was less the man I wanted to be than I'd been the year before. I'd violated more principles. And that's, to me, the first step. It says that I become everything that I swear I never want to be. And the only defense I had was to blame the Marine Corps. And that's what I did. I after 4 years, I was offered a commission. I worked hard for that. I had a few meritorious promotions. I was offered an appointment to go to Quantico to go to Officers Candidate School, and I turned it down because I knew that the Marine Corps was making me drink funny. In 1965, we did a little thing down in Santo Domingo, and I was blessed with excellent night vision, and they would test us for that. And I was an NCO, and every other night I would lead a patrol into town, and we'd often take fire and things, and from snipers and things. And in the night that I wasn't leading a patrol, I'd drink. And one morning I woke up and I was fully clothed, and I had my .45 on. The slide or the hammer was to the rear. There was a round in the chamber, and there were 3 rounds missing out of the magazine. It isn't normally the way I slept. And someone was waking me up, and they said, the captain wants to see you so that you can, you know, make a report of what happened last night. And I had no earthly idea what happened last night. Well, what had happened was evidently the other man who usually led patrols every other night was sick. And so after I had consumed a couple bottles of local fruit, rum, I got up, got dressed, let a patrol, a man, into a combat zone, took fire. By the grace of God, nobody was hit, and went back and lay down in my bed and went to sleep. And I don't remember any of it. And it terrified me. And they wanted me to explain what happened. And I, you know how we dance. And I said, I'll tell you, it's hard for me to remember. I mean, everything happened so fast. I'm thinking, really. And so, you know, I had to go around and sort of get the story from the guys. And to make out a report. And, And I knew then that my problem was the Marine Corps. It was an abnormal way to live, and it made me drink funny. And I got out, and you know what happened, of course. I went into a steel mill, and that's an abnormal way to live, and it made me drink funny. So I left there, and I went to work in a theologian, a Jesuit theologian. It was like this place, you know. 130 guys studying to be priests are already priests, right? And I used to go to their graveyard, too. I used to go over there and drink, carry on conversations with the headstones and things like that. I mean, just crazy stuff. And of course I left there. Just one hand. And then I got married, and you know, being married will make you drink funny. And you know how it is. And we had a couple of children on. And I'll share that with you as we go along. But the point is that I was in the throes of something that was dictating the course of my life. And I had no earthly idea what was happening to me. I didn't know Alcoholics Anonymous existed. I heard that at one time there was an organization back in the 30s or something called Alcoholics Anonymous, but it was a religious organization, and they had broken up because you no longer needed religion. I mean, you know, I didn't need a religion. I had an education. And only fools would, you know, worry about religion and all that sort of self-centered insanity that happens to us. But what I really want to remember about alcoholism was May the 13th, 1973, and I went into that bathroom to die, okay? I was completely powerless. My life was totally unmanageable. Everything I'd ever wanted or worked for was gone. I was morally, physically, and financially bankrupt. I wasn't permitted to see my children. I mean, everything was gone. I'd been drinking in a zoo. Mark reminded me of that. I used to drink in a zoo. I don't know if there's any zoo drinkers here, but I hope nobody drinks again. But if you do, I'd like to recommend a zoo. You know, you're gonna end up there anyway. You might as well go. And I used to drink in a national zoo. And I'll tell you how I did it, in case you're interested. I used to get a Tupperware glass, and I'd fill it up with whatever I had. You know, a 20-ounce glass, and I'd put an ice cube in it so I wouldn't be an alcoholic. If you use ice, you can't be an alcoholic. And then I'd put the lid on it and burp it. You know how you do. And I went down to the zoo. And there's a lot of places to drink in the zoo. The best place is the Ape House. I didn't bother anybody, so they didn't bother me. They had the old Ape House. They had bleachers, and you could sit on the bleachers and look at the apes. And I'd go to the very end, and I'd go up to the top so that I wouldn't bother anybody. And I was across from the cage where they had an orangutan. Now, you know, you could, you know, pick your favorite ape. Mine was the orangutan. It seemed to have a lot more personality. And what was really nice about it was excited to see me. And I must tell you, you know, no one had been excited to see me in a little while. It would jump up and down and things, and I'd wave you go to a place, you get to know everybody, somebody asked me if it was a male or a female. You know, it's hard to tell when an orangutan, it didn't matter because I was impotent by this time anyway, but I used to sit there, and this orangutan was great. I mean, he'd do all this stuff, or she, whatever it was, would do all the stuff I always wanted to do. And I remember one day, a family came in, you know, odd bunch, a man, a woman, and two children. And I mean, it's just strange looking thing. And they came in, and this orangutan sort of looked at me and had that glint in his eye, you know, and they were standing there looking and everything, and it settled down and it picked up a whole pile of droppings and pelted the whole family. And I jumped right on, you know, and then the orangutan looked at me in disgust and walked to the edge of the cave, and I began to curse it because, you know, rejection's something I've never been very good with. And so the keeper threw me out. He told me, he said, get out of here. He said, I don't mind you drunks hanging around here. He said, but, you know, we have families coming in here, and you can't be talking like that. And I said to him, sir, I'll never be back. And I wasn't. I mean, I had some pride, you know. I kind of considered that the end of my social drinking, because I then went back to this place I was staying in the basement of a house, and I went to where I needed to go, and it came down on me on May the 13th, 1973, and I went in there to die. And you know, I used to think suicide would be a big deal. I really didn't understand suicide, but I understand suicide now for the alcoholic. For the alcoholic, suicide's just the next thing. I'd spent 13 or 12 years trying to get back to Pittsburgh that night in Pittsburgh. It was the greatest night of my life. And I spent the next 12 years trying to get back to Pittsburgh. And no price was too great to pay to go to Pittsburgh. It's that simple. You know, and one day, you know, I went into the NCO club and I said, give me a double scotch on the rocks. I said, how much will that be? He said, 60 cents in your military career. I thought, well, that's about right. And I gladly paid it. And one day I went in for a bottle of gin and the man in the liquor store told me, he said, that'll be $6.75 in your wife and your two daughters. And I thought, that's about right. I paid it. I went to get some wine or something, and the guy said, well, you know, that'll be 75 cents in your life. And it seemed right. I mean, it really seemed right. It was just the next thing. And I had a bunch of pills in my medicine cabinet. I worked in hospitals, as did my estranged wife. And then they give you all the pills you wanted, you know, but I never took them. I was always afraid of them. Some of you think that's the saddest story you ever heard, but I just never took them. And so I had a medicine cabinet full, and I went in to take them all. And something happened to me, and it took me a number of years to understand this. And sometime, if you're interested this weekend, I'll be glad to share it with you. But I heard a woman spoke to me. And I said, I'm 29 years old, at least it'll be over. And a woman spoke to me. Now, I didn't like women. I'd married one. I gave them a chance. But I just didn't like them. So the fact that I heard a woman always mystified me. And this woman's voice told me not to kill myself. And it was just like, boom, all of a sudden, my mind was crystal clear, and I remembered that my estranged wife had given me a phone number, two phone numbers, and I ran in, and I pulled a drawer out, and it fell on the floor, and I found a phone number, and I called it. And that's how I understood the first step, because the woman on the other end of the phone had a British accent. Now, I don't know why, but there was something very soothing about the fact that this woman had a British accent. Now, we went to war with these people a couple hundred years ago, so I don't know why I trust them. But I did. It was just something very soothing about it. And it's like she knew what she was talking about, you know, because she had a British accent. And she did, because she knew how to talk to me. It was a treatment center, and she was a recovering alcoholic, and she talked to me, and she knew I was suicidal. And she asked me for my phone number. She said, I'll call you back in a minute. Well, I know now that she wanted to know how to tell the police to get a hold of me. I was that suicidal, and she knew it. And she called me back, and she said, how can I help you? And I said, if you don't help me, I think I'm going to die. Now, I didn't know I was alcoholic, but God gave me a gift, okay? And when I hung up that phone, I looked, and there was almost a full bottle of scotch on the draining board. Now, you got to know, I know nothing about alcoholism, and I know nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous, but I knew this. If I took one drink of alcohol, I would die. But more importantly, knowing I would die would never keep me from drinking. I knew that I had an illness that I could never be frightened into being sober. And I know that's true because I worked in a teaching hospital, and in this hospital you could go to, they would list the autopsies, you know, and what people died of, sort of like coming attractions. And if you were interested in something, you know, you could sign up and you could scrub in. And sometimes they'd have, you know, some old guy, you know, 40, 41 years old, something. You know, have died of acute chronic alcoholism, and I'd scrub into this post, and I'd watch, oh, it's an awful thing. I'd see the liver and the brain, oh, it's just awful. And I'd watch as much as I could watch, and I'd leave there, and I'd go down to Clyde's or Chadwick's. I'd go to Chadwick's and say, Vinny, you better give me a double. You'll never guess what I just saw. And he said, you always get a double. I said, well, make it a triple. So he'd give me a triple martini, and the rest of the guys at the bar would say, what did you see? And I'd explain to them what I just saw, but the brain and the liver and all that stuff, you know. And they'd say, my God, you better give us a triple too, Vinny. And we'd sit there, and I'd sit there till midnight drinking, and we'd discuss how can someone do this to themselves. And we concluded that there's some people just don't like themselves, just don't have any respect for themselves. And so I knew that I could never be frightened into not drinking. And that's important information, and that to me is a critical part of the first step. Yeah, I knew that I would drink again, okay? And I'll tell you how I envision the first step. And this is how I had to make pictures in my head, and this is a picture I made. May the 13th, 1973, I had my last drink up until today, by the grace of God, okay? Now, that's a very important date. You know, I mean, 1973, May 13th, 1970, is a big date in our house. You know, my lovely wife, cross stitches, okay? And that date is cross stitch on everything. I mean, you know, if you sat in my house, she'd cross-stitch it on you. I mean, that is a big day in our house. And yet, that's not the drink that's important. The drink that's important, and I want you to hear this, the drink that's important is the drink I must take. See, being alcoholic means I must drink again. Unless there's a miracle. And you're it. you're it. Okay? And I tell you how I see it. In the beginning, that drink was about 5 minutes ahead of me. Remember that? There were times, there were days I could smell it. You know, I go, there's scotch around here somewhere. You know, I'd be walking down the street, I'd go, who's drinking martinis? I mean, I just, you know, I could, I mean, it was that close to me. It was so close I could smell it. And then gradually, going to meetings, talking to people, going to coffee, things like that, I began to push the drink further and further ahead of me. And then pretty soon it was a day ahead of me, you know, and then maybe a week, and then maybe a month, you know. In a couple of years, you'd be out there like 3 months, you know. And then I'd say, I think I'll seek some balance. When an alcoholic begins to seek balance, what they're doing is looking for a good way to cut back on meetings, okay? And seeking balance for an alcoholic usually means seeking sex. Just the thought, you know. And so I begin to seek balance. Now what happened to me in those times is I'd stop doing a lot of things I was doing, and I'd begin to gain on that drink. I begin to catch up to that drink. Now, if I ever catch up to that drink, I'll drink it, because you see, I'm powerless over alcohol. Now, I've been around other people's drinks. I mean, I was on a plane today and there were people there. You know, that I'm not interested in their drinks. But there's a drink out there that's my drink. And if I catch up to it, I'll drink it. And the reason I'll drink it is because I'm powerless over alcohol. Okay? And it's there. Now, I do a lot of 12-step work. I go to hospitals and jails and all sorts of things on 12-step calls. And I can't tell you, hundreds of people have said to me in a hospital, I don't know what happened. I said, I know what happened. What happened was you caught up to the drink with your name in it, on it, you know. And if you catch up to it, you'll drink it. By the grace of God, I've never had to catch up to it. I've been close. I've been awfully close. You know, I go in those phases where I become an expert, you know. And I go to meetings late, and then I begin to criticize people. All right, I know what she's going to say. She always says the same thing. That's all she ever says. Wish she'd read a different book. Maybe she'd get a different, you know, and on and on and on. And what that means is I'm catching up to my drink. And so that's, to me, what the first step is all about. It's being powerless over alcohol and having, and that my life is unmanageable, okay? And that's critical to me to know that. It's absolutely critical. And, you know, the discovery I made back then is true today. If I take one drink of alcohol, I'll die. And no one I'll die will never keep me from taking it. That's why I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I have a sponsor that I talk to. And I don't just have a sponsor. I mean, I have a sponsor I talk to. And we sit down and I bring him. He says, let's get current. And I sit down and we get current. And he asks me just really pushy, obnoxious, personal questions. Things like, what were your motives? And I'll say, they were mine. and I sponsor guys. I sponsor a lot of guys. I'm a lucky man to sponsor the men I sponsor. And I sponsor a lot of them. And I sponsor them in prison. And I sponsor them by letter. And I sponsor them all sorts of ways. Okay? Because if I take a drink, I'll die. And knowing I'll die will never keep me from taking a drink. The only thing that will keep me from taking a drink is something that happened in 1935. A miracle happened in 1935, and I have the option of getting involved in that miracle. It's not my miracle. It's our miracle. And I can get in if I want. And that's the only thing I know that will keep me from drinking. The only thing I know. Now, other people may have some other plans. I don't have that plan because I'm a real alcoholic, and that means I'm powerless over alcohol. Okay? And if you're thinking that that means that if you take a drink, you can't predict your behavior, that's true. But it also means that left to my own devices, I must drink again. And that's a critical piece of information. That's the piece of information that I tended to forget the first few years I was sober. You know, the first few years I was sober, I was cursed with success. I don't know if anybody's had this experience. But I hit the road running, and I loved Alcoholics Anonymous from the very beginning. And from the very early on, and early on, very early on, I discovered something, okay? I discovered that something outside of me could help me. The second step says the power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. We came to believe that it's a process. And let me, if I may, let me take just a minute and explain that, and then we'll take a break, okay? My second daughter was born. Her name's Kimberly. And Kelly was my first daughter, and Kelly had a good sense to be born at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, so I was sober. Kimberly, on the other hand, decided not only to come at night, but to come about 3 months early. And I was doing what, you know, I think you ought to be able to do in your house. I was watching the test pattern on a TV, and some of you young people don't know what a test pattern is, but it used to be that that when you, you know, you drank, all the channels would go off the television, all three of them, and, you know, you'd hear the national anthem, and if you could stand up, you'd stand up, because after all, I am a former Marine, and... And then they have these jets fly over, and I'd cry, because I always cried at, when they played a national anthem, and when they had, you know, supermarket openings and most everything else. But I, and then I would proceed to watch the test pattern. Now, you know, it sounds boring, but, you know, you can vary it. You can lay down and watch it. You can stand up and watch it. And I'm watching a test pattern on the floor, and, I was in my underwear, and it's a very private thing to be watching the test pattern. And my wife decided it was time to have the baby, and she couldn't waken me. And I was tired. I worked hard. And so she had thrown water on me, which meant I was wet. And then because she panicked and she hated me, she invited the neighbors over. And when I opened my eyes, the neighbors were standing there watching me watch the test pattern in my underwear, And I was wet, and I quickly explained to them that she must have thrown something on me, because I'm not the kind of guy who would wet himself watching a test pattern, and they didn't seem to care. But you know, I got up, and somehow I got dressed, and I got my wife in her car, and I sped across town, and I went to the hospital where I worked, and it must have been mortifying for my wife, because I demanded that they take care of her, which was a joke, because I was the least considerate person in the world, but I demanded that she was my wife and they take care of her. And the baby was born, and she weighed about a pound and three quarters or something like that. And I got home, I just got home, and I just fell into bed, and the phone rang, and my wife was crying, and she said, the baby has hyaline membrane disease, and they don't think she's gonna live, and would you come back? And I remember I was just enraged. You know, I don't know how else to explain it. I was just angry. And I showered and I dressed and I went back to the hospital, and it began an odyssey that, just amazing to me. They're a very critical time with these kids. And 3 days before she was born, the hospital I worked at, Georgetown University, had ordered and received an experimental machine, very common now, called a negative respirator, but this is the first one they had. And it was put together the day before she was born. And the day she was born, the chief resident had gone to high school with me back in Ohio, and Mary Kate said to me, "Keith, we'd like to put your daughter on the respirator." She said, "We don't think she'll live. I'm sorry, but if she does live, we think she'll be retarded. But we would like to try." And the reason they wanted me to agree to it was I knew I worked there and I wouldn't sue them, you know. So I told them to do whatever they thought they could do. And then I never want to forget this, because the next few days, I discovered what had happened to me. Our friend Bob Brown used to say, "I'm not the man I used to be, and I never was." And I sat in an office. We had an office that we used that was across from the neonatal nursery, and I sat there at night, and I kept the door slightly ajar and the lights off so no one would know I was there. And I just watched this little thing fight for every breath. And these little infants, when they breathe, they retract, and they actually lift off the mattress. And she was fighting for every breath of life. I knew what my father would have done. My father was father of 11 children, and he knew how to be a father, and he knew how to be a husband, and I knew what he'd do. He'd be in there, and he'd have his arm around his wife, and he would be telling her, "We can do this together," and all that, and I couldn't do that. And I remember the night that my wife, she'd walk up and down the hall like she had a 1,000-yard stare, and her husband was 10 yards away and wouldn't open the door and go out and take her in his arms, because it was just, I couldn't. I don't know how to explain it. I just couldn't. There was just nothing there anymore. And I remember the night at 72 hours when it's very, very critical, and she went in and baptized our baby because they didn't believe she'd live through the night. And I ran down to the chapel. They had a chapel, and I hadn't been in it, and I hadn't been to church in quite a while. And alcoholism is a spiritual illness, and it certainly killed any spiritual life I had. And I went down there, and I was desperate, and I went into this little chapel. And I grew up in a Catholic church, and the tabernacle was a special place to us. And even when I was a little kid, I'd go playing ball. I'd run through the church and I'd say, "Hi, Jesus, I'm going to go play ball. You can come if you want." Even as a little kid, I just loved the tabernacle. I never went by the church that I didn't go in and visit. And I went in that night, and I got on my knees in front of the tabernacle, and I begged God to let my little girl live. And I said, if you'll let her live, I'll do anything. If you'll let her live, I'll stop drinking. And I was drunk in 12 hours. I drank when I thought drinking would kill my baby. Am I powerless over alcohol? My goodness, yes. You know, there's a great philosopher named Blaise Pascal, Frenchman. And he said God created man in his own image, and unfortunately man returned a favor. And I had created a God that would kill a little kid because her dad was sick. And that's how spiritually ill I was. And then I walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a perfect stranger standing at the door. Perfect stranger. I never saw this guy before in my life. And he had that smile on his face, you know. He said to me, you're new, aren't you? And I thought, oh my God, he's psychic. I mean, how's he know? And then he shook my hand. You know the way they do in Alcoholics Anonymous, with both hands. And then he looked me in the eye, which I always thought was kind of pushy, you know, kind of obnoxious. But he looked me in the eye, and one of those guys. And he said to me, you know, son, he said, if you keep coming here, you never have to drink again. And I wanted to scream at him, you don't know me. I'm a guy who drinks when he thinks drinking will kill his little girl. But he did know me because he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he knew that a power greater than me could restore me to sanity. He knew that you could do for me, you perfect strangers, could do for me what I could not do on my knees in front of the tabernacle. The safest place I'd ever been in my life. And of course God would work it out that way. If I could go in there and get what I needed, why would I need you? And if I didn't need you, I'd miss the best part of what God has in store for me. And you know, and Kimberly didn't die. She lived, and she's wasn't retarded. She graduated with honors from Auburn University. Now, I always tell her, I think you can be retarded and graduate with honors from Auburn University, but just kidding. And she a year ago Christmas presented me with my first granddaughter, Haley Noel, and she's a wonderful, wonderful child, and she's been a wonderful child her whole life, and she's gotten well, and she's just wonderful. She's a school teacher and married to a dentist, and they live in Daphne, Alabama, and just wonderful kid. She's been wonderful all her life, and I'm glad God didn't kill her because her dad was sick. And that's the second step. You know, I was sober 5 weeks, and I walked into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a man walked up to me, and he said, my name's Dick. What's your name? And I said, it's Keith. He said, is this the first time at this meeting? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, well, I'd like to get you a cup of coffee. I'd like to buy you a cup of coffee. And we went over, and he said, tell me, do you have a job? I said, well, I think I do. I said, I used to work at the university. I don't know if I still have it or not. And I said, I'll find out tomorrow. And he said, well, that's good. And he said, are you married? And I said, well, no. I said, she threw me out. And he said, well, you have any children? I said, I have two little girls, but I'm not allowed to see them. And he said, oh, what are their names? And I said, well, Kelly and Kimberly. And he said, you know, he said, I've never seen a father get sober and not see his children. And I, that's nice. I mean, you know, you're supposed to say nice things. I mean, you have a room full of phonies and they say nice stuff, you know. And so I came back the next week and I walked in the door, and this man, I remembered him, but I didn't know his name. And he came over and he said, remember me? My name's Dick. And I said, yeah. And he said, Keith, how's it going? I said, well, fine. He said, you stay sober all week? I said, yes, I did. He said, that's wonderful. He said, so did I. And he said, you still have your job at Georgetown? I said, yeah, yeah. He said, that's great. And then he said, how's Kelly and Kimberly? He remembered the names of my children. So you've got to come to believe that something greater than you can restore you to sanity. To someone who was so fiercely isolated and so desperately alone, that when I was living with my wife, there were nights I'd lay there knowing that she couldn't be my wife because I couldn't be that close to anybody. I felt like a perfect stranger laying next to him I was married to. And the nights I'd go down the hall and the kids would be asleep and I'd go in and I'd touch their little heads and I knew they couldn't be mine because nothing that nice could have come from me. And then there's a man who remembers the names of my kids. There really is a power greater than ourselves that can restore us to sanity. There's something that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous that's more powerful than anything in any place I've ever been. I love my church. I go all the time. I snuck into Mass. I was one of the people that were angry at the kitchen for being late for dinner. I snuck into Mass and this evening, and I go as often as I can. Okay? I love it. You know, and I, of course, experience power there. But God has built me. So here's where I experience a special kind of power. This is the kind of power that gives me what I need to go and do what it is I need to do. This is the power that restores me to sanity. I can isolate in church. I stayed in a monastery. I've done a lot of things sober. And I can isolate every place in the world except in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I cannot isolate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because here I have something of value. Here I have something that's special and unique. I've been given a gift that only I can deliver to another alcoholic, and that's sobriety. And the greatest minds in the world can't carry to a sick alcoholic what you and I can carry. And that's the power of the second step. That's coming to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. Bill describes it beautifully in the 12 and 12. Describes it beautifully. And he talks about what stands in the way of that and how we come in hostile and all the rest of it. And the bottom line is none of that matters. I mean, my hostility or my fear or my anger or anything else is puny compared to the love that you have for me. Not because I'm who I am, but because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You must love me. You must care for me. Your very life depends upon it. People love me who don't even like me. They do. They must. They have no choice. Absolutely no choice. And that's the power of the second step. It's something that transcends any... I don't understand it. It's the most amazing thing to me. The second step and the sixth step and the seventh step have always astounded me. The power in those steps is unbelievable. And I have to draw pictures, and one of the pictures I have of the second step is a tree. And I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm standing on a limb, and I'm grasping the trunk of the tree for all it's worth. And you said to me, look, move out a little bit. Move out a little bit. And so I begin to move out on a limb, and I get further and further out on a limb. It's called getting free. And I'd be out there for a little while, and all of a sudden I'd realize I'm way out here on my own, and I shouldn't be here, and on. And you'd say, wait a minute. You know, God has a perfect plan for you. He's got a name. He's got a plan with your name on it. It's Keith's plan. Can you imagine God putting together Keith's plan? I mean, it's an astounding thing to me when I think about it. He has a perfect plan for me. Now, he doesn't rely on me. I rely on him. But if I suit up and show up, he'll use me. I'll give you an example, and then we can take a break. I was speaking once out in Oregon. It's been some years ago, pretty long time ago, because in Washington State, I'm sorry, and because... You know, I was going to be leaving, and I spoke, and there were a couple thousand people there, I guess, and people were kind enough to come up and thank me, and one man came up, and I don't know why I said this. I said, could I have your phone number? And he looked at me, and he wrote his name and phone number down, and I don't know why I said it. I just did, you know. And I put it in my pocket, and I had to catch a flight right after that to get back, and so I was going through Chicago, and I was supposed to go from Chicago into Raleigh, and I was living in Fayetteville at the time, and then down to Fayetteville. And I loved coming home because Julie was then my fiance, and she would come over and build a fire. And I had a little house out on the golf course, and she'd build a fire, and I'd come home, and we'd have hot tea or hot chocolate or something. And I'd tell her about the trip and about the conference and the people that I met and all that. And it was wonderful. And, you know, I was madly in love with this woman, and I wanted to see her. So I get to Chicago, and they said, you know, Raleigh's going to be snowed in, so we're going to take you through Atlanta. And so they fly me to Atlanta, and the problem was they couldn't get me from Atlanta home. So I'm stuck there, and it's the Democratic National Committee's in Atlanta. Okay? Remember, that's how long ago it was. And so they said, well, we'll give you a certificate for a hotel room. And I'm thinking, I don't want a hotel room in Atlanta. I want to go home to... And so I went outside, and I said, God's got to have a plan here. I'm going to look for it. Maybe it's somebody I can help. I'm looking around, see who I can help, and nobody gives a damn in Atlanta if you help them or not. So finally, I get to this hotel, and I said to the guy... The airlines gave me this certificate, said you would honor it for a room. The guy said, you got to be crazy. He said, I got one room. He said, I'm not only going to give you that room, not going to give you that room for nothing. I want to charge you twice as much as it's worth. I mean, he's right up front. You got to give him credit. Probably a member of Al-Anon. He just laid it right out there. Sorry, Sean. And so I'm mad, you know, I'm grumbling, and I thought, take the room. And I went upstairs, and I was really mad. And I called Julia and said, I won't be in, and this and that and everything. I'm whining, you know, grumbling, and I got ready to go to bed, and I took stuff out of my pocket, and I saw that card with that man's name on it. And I said, I better call him. And I called him. And he answered the phone, and I said, yeah, I said, I met you today. I'm Keith, remember? And he said, you're the man who spoke. And I said, yeah. And he started to cry. I said, what's the matter? He said, I got a gun. I'm going to kill myself. And And I talked to him, and I called a guy who had hosted me, and a guy lived a block away. And I said, I'm going to call him back and talk to him. Get over there. And he got over there, and they got him help, and they got him in the hospital. He's depressed, and got him in the hospital, and he's okay. And I thought about it. I was sitting in this overpriced room, and I was overwhelmed by the grace of God that he would use me. You know, someone who hated himself the better part of his life, and God could use me. And every time something, and you know, if I had my way, I'd have gone home and had hot chocolate with my fiance and told her all about the wonderful people I met. And maybe a day or two later, I'd have called and maybe the line would have been disconnected. You know, God has a perfect plan. It amazes me that he includes me. And that's what the second step tells me. The second step tells me that he loves me so much that he'll include me in his plan. And in matter of fact, he'll even make me kind of important in my own little piece of it. You know? And if I stay sober, I get to go through that. That's what the second step is, exactly where I'm supposed to be. It's an amazing way to live if you're kind of new. God is an amazing way to live. And don't leave before you begin to feel and experience some of this stuff. Why don't we take a break, okay?